Hi everyone, this is Avanti Nagro, and I'm a singer, content creator, older sister, human, and you are now listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Yeah. My name is Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with talented and interesting individuals linked to the global Indian and South Asian community. It's informal and informative, adding insights to our evolving cultural expressions, where each person can proudly say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. Hi, everyone. On this episode of Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing, we share a conversation with singer, activist, and content creator Avanti Nagral. Stay tuned. Once again, a heartfelt thanks to everyone for listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing, and sharing it with your friends and family, and of course for following us on that good old social media. If you're enjoying these conversations, please take a moment to submit a kind rating and review wherever you might be listening or watching, as it's truly, truly appreciated. So I'm often fascinated by our community's ability to express themselves. Sometimes it's loud, but not obvious, like the sex appeal of a great Hindi film that has no love scenes and not even a kiss. Sometimes it's bold and profound and there's really no subtlety, like landing on the moon or leading a cricket team to victory or starting a political movement. And among the more interesting versions, I think it's capturing the attention of a generation by creating space to be yourself and challenging norms, by simply showing people how you're developing by gathering agency and trust along the way. It's the kind of blend that was at the heart of a conversation that I shared this past summer with singer and content creator Avanti Nagral. Avanti was born in Boston and raised in Mumbai with the rigors of academics and the comfort of music. She was the first person to enroll for a dual degree from the Berklee School of Music and Harvard University, and she's found a way through her experiences to finally thread many needles. Her musical expressions weave pop, soul, Broadway, classical, and gospel influences into a very decidedly Indian sound. Avanti's own health experiences and passion for advocacy have sparked an activism in content creation around women's issues, sexual health, gender equity, and mental health with true honesty and an open, relatable education that even taps into the wisdom of her Aji, or grandmother. For someone who recently just turned 26, Avanti's performances breed empowerment, being thought-provoking without provocation. And her 2022 album Quarter Life Crisis and recent single Bate find her exploring the questions of her generation and trusting those explorations. We chatted about the many connections of her content and experiences, about relevance and empathy, and even privacy. But we started by chatting about the intersection that many young people, and perhaps those who aren't so young, find themselves often at.
I'm going to borrow something from your song 25, where you sing about kind of being a dumb kid, but you're also coming into your own. So I was curious for you, what does it actually feel like to be coming into your own?
That's a good question. So I just exited, hopefully, my quarter-life crisis. I just turned 26 last week. So I feel old, only because, you know, the news reports on 26-year-old women, and you're like, wow, they're so old. And I'm like, that is now me.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think, you know, the last couple of years have been really interesting times. I think they've just been inflection points in my life in many different ways, personally, professionally, emotionally. And so there's just been a lot of learning and growth, and I think that's what it means to come into your own. And I think that there is so much learning in all parts of your life. Like, one thing I value the most in life is growth. I'm scared of stagnancy. And when I say growth, I think, you know, we sometimes in our hyper-capitalistic world think of productivity as growth, which I'm learning to disassociate with, because I think that that is an aspect of it, but it is not what defines growth. Yeah, I'm just learning to grow in different ways every day. And I think that's what coming into your own means, where you have the realization that you are doing that and trying to take active steps toward doing that.
If when growth is happening, and for you, do you embrace that? Has that come as a sort of surprise, or have you always been someone who has really embraced growth, you know, moved with the way that water flows and sort of, you know, allowed that to sort of come to you kind of naturally? Does that allow you to, in some ways, kind of be a shapeshifter when it comes to different situations, different people, different ideas, and ways to kind of grow?
That's a great question. I think that I've actually grown into being more fluid and flexible over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
My life has always had change, you know. In the last 4 weeks, I have been in five different cities across 3 different continents. I'm used to constant change, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're used to constant, you know, flexibility and like you said, being a shapeshifter. I think actually when I was younger, I had more particular ideas about the world, but a lot of it's the profession I'm in. A lot of it's the people I choose to surround myself with and the learnings that nothing is in your control. And so I think it's a more recent phenomenon where I am learning to accept going with the flow. I'm not a very patient person. And so I'm learning to let go of that because I realize that so much is not in your control. The only thing that's in your control is your intentionality and the work you put in and how you show up to things. So everything else can keep shifting.
You know, speaking of intentionality and the work you put in, you're someone who expresses themselves in many, many ways, right? Through singing, through acting, through advocacy, through empowerment. I'm curious, is there one of these lanes that for you, you most find kind of sanctuary and solace in? Do you feel most at home in one of those spots?
That's a great question because I've been reflecting on that actually in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
I think the answer to that is no, and not because I think I cannot pick a lane, but I just think that each of them affords a different side to myself. And a different skill set or just a different form of expression. The way I often talk about tying it all together is I say that there's the common thread among all of them is the voice, right? Whether that's your literal yeah. singing or speaking voice or writing voice or your metaphorical in the way that, you know, as an advocate, you can kind of amplify other voices and causes. So I think for me, it's learning how to continue to use that. And so therefore developing the craft in that.
Yeah.
But I think at different points, you have to choose different things, right? And so I'm excited to see as things shape up. The beauty of some of the creative fields is that you often work on things based on projects, right? So you're currently working on an album that takes a lot of your energy, and other things don't take a backseat, but they're just more in the background. If I'm working on an acting project, that takes my energy just because it's full body, emotional, physical, mental energy. And I think that's a cool way to continually boot camp your skills throughout life, if that makes sense. And so
Totally.
I really like the fact that that is the way that life is at the moment.
Well, and it sounds like all of those spots, all of those lanes feel like they're sanctuary and solace for you. And, you know, does every boot camp feel like you have to in fact reset the idea that it's sanctuary? There must be some discomfort perhaps at the beginning of those projects where you're just like, okay, hey, there is some learning, you know, involved there. And do you have to hit the reset button too often? Does that sometimes feel disjointing?
I don't think it's the reset button. I think I'm at a stage in my life right now where I'm like, okay, I've reached a certain level because of the certain training that I've had, the work I've put in. But if I want to level up, right, there's so much work that's left to be done. I might have put in 10,000 hours, but what are the next 10,000? And so that's what I'm thinking about right now in terms of, I don't think it's a reset, but it does feel in some ways a clean slate where it's like, okay, you've done this. But I think that it's easy to get complacent sometimes. And so rather than being like, I've built all of this and now I'm, you know, doing whatever, it's like, okay, if I were starting from zero, which I kind of am, even though you've built whatever you've built, how do I go at it with the same energy and passion that I did when I was starting out?
Well, and then, you know, as you mentioned, the voice is the thing that connects all the dots together. You know, having sort of like plain sight of that is amazing. We were just talking, I think, about our grandparents, and I wanted to just like touch on one thing, which is so much of your content is geared towards youth and, you know, relevant to Gen Z and definitely to a digital crowd. And yet some of the most powerful and authentic and playful and even sort of tender content has come from working with your Aji. I'm so interested in what you think about, does the generational conversation make the content more complete and maybe even more evergreen, especially when so much of this is in this kind of temporary space where, I mean, our attention spans are just so diverted all the time and we don't have the time to digest. Does working with someone like your Aji make that sort of pan-generational content a little bit more evergreen and lasting?
I think so. One thing is, it's one, a way for me to spend time with her. I think she really enjoys it. It's become, you know, a cadence that we do. And it's a way for her, she's actually starting to lose her memory. I mean, she's 90, right? So it's just a natural part of aging. But I think these things help center her, so it's very fun. And to just glean those nuggets. I think one thing I realized is, for example, when I started talking about things that are perhaps more taboo in, say, our cultural fabric, such as sex ed or things of that nature, when I would talk about it, a lot of younger folks would find it, let's say, maybe relatable or something of that nature, because it felt like perhaps an older sister type of person is talking to them, right?
Yeah.
But the second I have my 90-year-old sari-wearing, very traditional Maharashtrian aji talking with me, suddenly it becomes something that you can also share with your parents. And your parents cannot say to you, oh, but she's 20-something, Western-educated, blah, blah, blah. They'll be like, pranam, to whoever's grandmother it is, right? And they kind of have to shut up, sit down, and listen, right? So it becomes actually, I've seen a way for that younger generation to bridge that gap with their older generation when you have these conversations. And my mom told me when I was fairly young, she just said to me one day, she's like, if the onus on bridging the gap between generations lies on both, right? I found that as I've gotten older, I think when I turned 18 and, you know, around that time, I started realizing that my parents, yes, they're parents, but they're also humans with flaws. And sometimes that breaks the sheen if you, you know, have your parental unit as a pedestalized unit. And it becomes a really hard transition from their end too, that you're no longer a child, you're an adult child, and then hopefully an adult. And I think that transition was not easy for many reasons, but I see that with a lot of people, right? And I think in those moments, kind of like when we're teenagers, we tend to have friction with our parents. In those moments, it can go one of two ways. It can go the way of, we don't understand each other, we're different generations, we never will. Or it can go the way of, okay, let me explain to you my perspective, and perhaps that might help you explain yours. And I think that allows for discourse. And one thing I've realized is just in general with conversation, the more perspectives you bring, the more discourse you're able to have, the more you might come to just some sort of, just an interesting way that you've tackled something where it doesn't have to have an agreement, but you're just like, okay, this is something that feels meaningful.
Well, and on top of that, like, it sounds, I wonder if, you know, having that open discourse, realizing the flaws in every generation, do you think that's rubbed off on particularly the younger youth-based crowd where they see things like this and they're perhaps more open to having that discourse and sort of being a little bit of more self-aware? And for that matter, the older crowd saying like, hey, I have a little bit of better understanding now of what it's like to be younger and have that kind of, again, sort of pan-generational conversation. I wonder if the feedback you've gotten has been that, it totally rubs off, or I can relate to this a lot easier now.
I think the feedback I've gotten has been really fascinating because a lot of folks who will say, come up and say hello in public spaces tend to be either younger, you know, high school or college students, or it'll be their parents who'll be like, my kid loves you, or or they'll be like, I watched something and it allowed me to relate to my daughter more or relate to whatever, right?
Yeah.
And that to me is really, really cool and powerful because, for example, sometimes if I've spoken about something related to, say, bodily autonomy, right? And in whatever way I'm talking about it, I'll find a lot of older women saying, I wish that I had this conversation when I was your age or younger because it would have made me not feel shame around my body so many years later, right? And so I never used to, growing up or until recently, I recognize the power of art. I recognize the power of music. I recognize the power of art in itself, right? Because it connects with you emotionally. It allows you to, you know, almost have an escapist mindset, connect with something deeper, and it can affect change. So I've seen that and I've known that about music and other forms of art for a long time. But it's only recently that I realized that conversation in and within itself is so powerful. And I've felt I love people and I love meeting people. So I feel that every time I exchange energy with someone and meet them, but it was only recently that I realized that with videos, for example, you know, I recognize that some of the conversations Aji and I might have some sort of a thought-provoking impact potentially on somebody, which is incredible. I saw that with her, where I remember, for example, all my grandparents are doctors, and you know, sometimes in medical training in those days, it was very biologically based. And so, for example, my grandma did not have as much of a nuanced perspective on the LGBTQIA+ community, right? And it was something that I tried to explain to her, where she's like, I'm tolerant of whatever, but it wasn't something she clearly understood. And, you know, she was just like, but biology, X chromosomes, Y chromosomes, whatever, right?
Right.
And so I was like, huh. So I printed out a bunch of pages of research and reading that I thought would speak to her. I also shared it with my other grandfather. He read all the papers, did his markings. We had a conversation. It was great. Aji kept hiding the papers. She just kept forgetting about it. And I was like, what is going on? So I forced her to sit down in front of me one day. And I had made a video with a friend of mine who's a drag queen and activist, and where we'd broken down all these concepts and, you know, just had a conversation, understanding. And that 15-minute video changed my 90-year-old grandmother's opinion. And I was like, that is crazy. That's powerful. If a 90-year-old woman who just has a lot of ways about life, you know, that, like, she could teach us about so many things, then there's power in conversation. I'm not saying it's because we are having the conversation. I'm saying conversation itself is so powerful.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, the idea that conversation is art, that it has power, that it has purpose, and that it could actually, you know, have surprising touches on, you know, people who, whether it's changing their mind, whether it's reaffirming something, but the idea that that's a surprise sometimes, especially, like, you know, how open you can be, especially if you just start listening and come at it with a lot of empathy.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, we'll come back to our conversation with singer, activist, and content creator, Avanti Nagral. Stay tuned. Conversation. It's the antidote to apathy and the catalyst for relationships. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tam France, and you are listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hi, I'm Marwan Arani. I'm a chef and restaurateur. My restaurant group is called the Chai Pani Restaurant Group. I'm also a spice merchant. My company is called Spicewala. And you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Welcome back to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with Avanti Nagral.
You mentioned that your grandparents are all doctors, and you went through a bout of optic neuritis and, you know, that kind of long recovery from that too. I'm curious, in reflecting on that experience now, what did you particularly learn about empathy, and how did that maybe factor into some of the artistic expressions that you've had?
I learned a lot about empathy, and that's actually, I love that you framed it as such, because, so optic neuritis was not my first experience with those types of, you know, issues. I was born with a hole in my heart. I had a few other, you know, diagnoses through my life, which fortunately all turned out okay. And my realization through all of that was part of the reason they did was because I had access to care in ways that many people don't, right? And that was through, obviously, family having access, being so many doctors, but also socioeconomic background. And so for me, I'd always had empathy toward realizing that health is a privilege, and the equity around that is not something to be taken lightly, and compassion around that is not something to be taken lightly. I think my bout with optic neuritis, because it was very scary, lost, you know, vision temporarily, it affected my memory a little bit. I think at the time, because I was a teenager, I had a little bit of an identity crisis, because a lot of my identity had been wrapped up in being a really good student and blah, blah, blah. And because it affected parts of my memory, I was very shaken up as to who am I and what is my place in the world. And the thing that really got me through all of that was music. You know, music had been a huge part of my life generally. Like, I grew up doing classical music and church music and so many other things. And it was always a very strong passion and hobby. But it was that determined for me that I knew it had to be a part of my life in whatever way, no matter what I did, because it in and within itself was super healing. And I recognized its healing powers for me. Recognize its powers in general as this medium, as this vehicle, as whatever you want to call it. And so really launched that and I think developed empathy in those ways. I saw the empathy my classmates had toward me, you know, which was really kind and reassuring because, you know, you're out of school for a little, again, at that age, that's your defining experience of life. So you're like, oh my God. And then I come back with, you know, it took a while and, you know, there was like puffy eyes and steroids and blah, blah, blah. So also at the time, you know, you think about your beauty standards and all of that, right? So I'm like, I look so ugly and blah, blah, all these, you know, things. No.
Self-image and self-esteem.
Of course.
Yeah.
No, it really just taught me the power of compassion, care, really showed me how powerful art can be. And it really kind of, for me, was the launching factor into at least a little bit of what I do today and hopefully what I continue to do, you know?
Has the empathy been critical for you? Does it make you a better storyteller?
I think that empathy is a quality I've been lucky enough to develop for a while, so from a young age, just because I had a lot of exposure at a young age. And I think when you have a lot of exposure, it allows you to develop empathy. But I think empathy makes me a better listener. And I think when you're a better listener, you therefore are a better observer, and therefore you might be able to translate that. I don't think empathy directly translates into creativity, because creativity can come from different places. But I think it allows you to be an active listener, and therefore it makes sense that the mediums that I use are primarily voice-oriented, because it's taking in a lot of information and figuring out how to use my voice to channel that.
And the fact that hopefully that keeps evolving, you know, over time, and allows you to grow, as we were talking about. Do you ever Google yourself?
Okay, this is really embarrassing, but I have Google alerts that's my name. I get information just because we kind of have to know what's being said PR-wise or like whatever.
Yeah.
I'll occasionally Google myself just to see if, you know, what probably shows up for people as, you know, top searches. Yeah.
I mean, right, by necessity. I mean, I ask because I'm curious about how you might perceive your work, yourself, and are measuring or respond to what success looks like or what it's defined as in some ways.
I think success totally depends on the person, right? And different measures of success. Like, I have certain people in my life, whether they're family members or people, who I'll report on different metrics of success too, because I think that that will matter to them most. There's some people in my life who I know that, say, the money I'm making this year is a measure of success to them. For some people, the impact, right? Like, these are the types of feedback I'm getting, these are the types of comments, that means more to them. For some other people, it means, hey, have you upskilled yourself at all, right? So I think success is measured by different ways.
Sure.
And I think for me personally, it comes down to your more traditional measures, right? Quantitative. Are they enough to sustain and sustainably grow, right? So for example, teams I'm working with, is everybody getting paid equitably, fairly? Can this sustain and can it scale so that they're also feeling comfortable in that way? What I'm trying to say is numbers are less important to me than people actually meaningfully having feedback, right? So I know that eyeballs, like, sure, there are certain things I could do in this attention economy to get 2-3x times the eyeballs, right? But would that necessarily mean the potential impact and feedback? Not necessarily, right? So it's just always those trade-offs, because sure, more numbers lead to more money, but then at what cost? And then all of those types of things, right?
Yeah, it's a big weave, and it's so integrated. But I'm even thinking about the, you know, the empathy piece that we thought about, you know, just now, and in some ways kind of using those quantitative Google metrics as a mirror of the work. And yet it's not as simple as that, right? Hey, I wonder if, like, taking all that together and balancing those things, and when you're doing that, do you think that's made you, you know, as you've had to think about those things, do you think that's made you a better leader?
I hope so. I hope to keep growing into that role. I think that there's ways in which I've been trained to be a leader in many parts of my life, and then there's ways in which I can definitely learn. The word leader is interesting, right? Because I think as young kids, you're like, someone's a leader and someone's not. And also because of the phraseology we use, I have followers, But that doesn't necessarily mean I'm like some Pied Piper leading these followers. These are people that like actively chosen to have a parasocial relationship, right?
Yes. You're hypnotizing people into following, right? Yeah. Yeah. Stirring the pot along the way.
Exactly. But no, I think that it's a... That's why I don't like the word follower. I don't like the word fan because I think it creates this weird hierarchy.
Sure.
So I just think that navigating this balance, as you said, comes with trying to understand that some people might look up to you in whatever way, right? You may be directly a leader in that you have an... We run our work like a startup. We have an organizational structure within that. And there are some people who report in, and so therefore you might be leading them in that way. Great. But when it comes to these other folks that, you know, you've built a community with, it comes with a sense of responsibility, which therefore does make me feel like a leader. But at the same time, I don't want it to feel, therefore, that I have this thing where I'm, like, preaching, you know, if that makes sense. It's a delicate balance, because I think it's important to develop those qualities without overtly being like, oh, I'm the leader. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. I think it's also a little bit different when your product is an expression and it's art and it's, you know, really conversation. And yet there are some natural boxes that you sometimes have to follow in, right? I mean, you have to keep your people paid equitably. You have to run a operation in some ways. And there is some kind of nuts and bolts to it, along with the, you know, artistic value of what you're doing. In this space, of course, right, you're someone whose life and cultural expressions are very public, and they're very front-facing, and genuinely providing an accelerator for the conversations we were just talking about. And, you know, otherwise would be totally, for many of these topics, they could be completely closeted or shoved under some rug. In thinking about the things, both like the topics that you might talk about, but even your own personal identity that's been crafted and shared, what do you think you've learned about privacy and what that maybe means to different people?
I learned that, number one, data privacy is really important because our data is everywhere. And making sure that we have that under control. When you're running a digital operation, that is really important, right? I keep my friends in tech close and ask them to just do a little check, you know, like one of my friends
little check in.
No, I kid you not, one of my friends literally tried to hack me to see how hackable I was. And they were like, these 10 things are really hackable. And I was like, I'm going to go for that.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely.
So that's quite literal data. But in terms of privacy, in other ways, I have no qualms about being an approachable, vulnerable person. But I recognize that I also have to protect certain aspects of my privacy. And I realized that a lot last year in particular, because I had... a fairly public breakup, for example. And while I still kept a lot of information private, I just, you know, shared a nugget of information about a reason, because I know if I didn't, then people would have had assumptions. And then anything else I shared had to do with my own emotions. But it's interesting because people will always interpret, right? And when you put out anything publicly, it's open to criticism, it's open to love, it's open to all of the above. And typically, so for example, in the past when I've talked about difficult topics, for example, I have quite literally shared my self-pleasure and masturbation journey, which it doesn't get more private than that to some degree, but the whole point of doing that was to make it not private and a shame-based conversation, right?
Sure.
Anything I got in response to that as feedback, I was like, okay, people have certain views about this, right? And perhaps it's changing. Honestly, for the most part, the feedback was super positive, where people were like, I wish I had this comfort and, you know, didn't feel shame and it whatever. But when people hate on that kind of stuff, it makes me realize, okay, we need to talk about it more. But when it's something that's so personally related, it's the confusion of, okay, wait, who's the persona? Who's the person? Are they the same? Are they different? What do people know? What do they not? And I realized, you know, people were making assumptions based off of the meme or something else you might have seen, and I'm like, okay, that's the persona.
Right.
This is the person. And while I try to keep them very similar, for example, as an artist, I could have chosen to have a stage name. There are several who do. But I kind of wanted to be the same Avanti that you see on stage, off stage, you know, and that's who I am, and that's what felt most authentic to me. But it comes with a cost, and it comes with a cost of people feeling like they know you super well too, which I'm always grateful for. Yesterday,
yeah,
I was at an event and you know, someone came up to me and they were talking about how me talking about certain things had, you know, affected them in certain ways, and they're like, "Are you okay? How is life?" And like in ways they were talking to me as if it was a close friendship, but then they were also talking in ways that almost felt, I guess, how do I put it? It felt very, it's like, whoa. You know,
was that intrusive or?
Not intrusive, but I'm like, you know so much about me. And that's part of it is because I decided to put that on the internet.
Yeah.
Right? But I didn't realize the degree to which people pay attention. Sure. Like, I remember this thing was from that time, from this. And I was like, oh my God, that is crazy. Right. And it's, I put this out there, so it's totally
fine. Right, right.
You know, but I'm like,
I mean, it's all part of the kind of universe that you build, right? That people are paying attention to what's in the sky and what's around, and because they feel like they're so connected to you in that way.
And I'm super grateful. But it's funny, as public as my life seems, I'm actually pretty private about certain things, and that's really intentional. Yeah. For example, consent is really important to me as a baseline factor. So I have a lot of friends who are not comfortable being on the internet, a lot of family members who are not comfortable being on the internet. You will never know that I hang out with them. You will never know that something else is going on, because that is not their comfort, right? And that's totally okay. There is certain aspects to my life now that are a little bit more private than public.
Yeah.
And if I feel comfortable being public about them, I will. Here's the thing. I think it's possible to talk about experiences and talk about your emotions and the way you thought about them without sharing specific details about them that might feel private to someone else. I don't know how you feel about this actually as a parent. I'm curious. But I was talking with a friend the other day about the conundrum of sharing your children on the internet, right? And what that might feel like. And you know, I think, for example, let's say somebody goes through pregnancy, they can talk about their experiences with that. They can talk about all of those sorts of things. When it comes to sharing children, there's just all these ethical and moral lines that are so gray and ambiguous. That's
completely,
you know, it's like hard because you can understand the intention, but sometimes what that could lead to is something else. And so it's just complicated. I think
it's messy. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's like, And it sort of speaks a little bit also in a way, both the ethics of it, but then also thinking about the power of it.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's take a break real quick, but then come back to our conversation with singer, activist, and content creator, Avanti Nagral. Every story told is a lesson learned, and every lesson learned is a story waiting to be told. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Lily Singh, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hi everyone, my name is Prachi Shivgaonkar. I'm the founder of Cool the Globe, an app and a movement for climate action. And you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hi there, I'm Abhay Dandekar, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with singer, activist, and content creator, Avanti Nagral.
You know, you mentioned you just turned 26, and when you think about it, where you're creating and performing and in a way kind of reflecting and gracefully aging, what are some of the accelerators perhaps as you think about creating content and putting it out there? What are some of those accelerators of relevancy? How do you stay relevant in this game, so to speak?
I think a lot of it has to do with how you... So platforms will change, algorithms will change, all of this will constantly change, right? For example, TikTok is banned in India, right? So that's a platform I haven't had access to for a majority of the last few years. The algorithms keep changing what they're prioritizing. So I think how best you can stay platform agnostic, I think that's a useful tool. do you have, see, as a performer, I do already have a natural offline, you know, piece to some degree.
Right.
But that's not possible for all types of content, right? So how are you able to make sure that lives, like you said, evergreen, right? That lives on in some way beyond just the context. And I think there's power to that.
Right.
You know, for example, when we, one of the things we've done in the past that we're being more intentional about is how do you create offline experiences to this community that connects them? Whether that's something as simple as we realized that we had people in our community and something that's really important to me who care very deeply about climate change. So we organized a beach cleanup in you know, collaboration with an environmentalist to spotlight their work and also have people participate and hang out with each other. And the thing that was most fun to me was that people have stayed friends afterward and sent pictures and, you know, things of that nature, which is really cool. I think
it's a lot of community building then.
It's community. And that's why I do what I do. Like, to me, that's the primary part of it. Besides expression, besides all of the other things, right? And so if you care deeply about community, for me, I think anything I do and how to stay successful is how does your community feel? And they may not be cohesive, right? I recognize the community is actually pretty diverse, but do they feel connected? Do they feel like we share resources a lot because do we get paid to share resources? No. Do we think it's important to? Yes. And is it a lot of work to make sure they're verified? Yes. But I think that's really important, right? That, in any community, you give back, and that's kind of the way in which you give back to the community. And sure, that might be a process that sounds like a slower burn, which it is, because there are certain ways to increase and stay relevant, right? And I know that sometimes you, of course, have to play the game. I think, you know, for example, one way in which people do that is they will jump onto trends. I think that sometimes when trends exist, you can find your own expression to them. But I think it's more useful if you are a trend creator, right? Or figure out ways to say, okay, this is what's working, whatever that means. How can I best have my form of expression toward that?
Yeah.
And just stay on top of it and honest and continually upskill. I really am, we've been feeling in a space of we've built whatever we've built. And because there's constantly things changing, both from a, I feel like I need to upskill as a person, but also I think our community is growing with us. How do we serve them better, right?
I'm always thinking about this from, you know, the standpoint of A, being a pediatrician, but being twice your age in that way of, you know, like thinking about how nostalgia for youth, I'm wondering how much does nostalgia for youth keep your expression sort of fresh and vibrant and thought-provoking? Or is it embracing aging and maturing gracefully?
Yeah.
Does that itself add its own kind of ongoing vibrancy? And it's not necessarily a nostalgia thing.
That's actually, I like that framing because one thing I've realized, for example, when I started out in the content space specifically, I've been doing music for longer than that. I was younger. I was 23. And at that time, I was closer in age to a lot of the people who are an active part of our community. I am now older, right? And I will continue to be. And so I have different approaches. Either I can have the approach of I am trying my best to stay young and relatable and cool. I'm technically Gen Z. I'm the first year of Gen Z, but my brother, who's 4 years younger than me, keeps reminding me that I'm an old person, you know?
That's right. Yeah, you can always leave it to your younger siblings to remind you of that.
Exactly. But I
no matter what age they are, by the way.
No matter what age, I can only imagine.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
all very true.
I feel young because I'm on a daily basis talking to 13-year-olds, people who are half my age, right? But the fact that I say that I feel young means I'm definitely old, right? It's just, it's one of those things. You wouldn't say you feel young if you're young.
Totally.
But I think what I've realized is for a lot of folks, they might, because of this, what I really like in our cultural fabric is we have this feeling of what in Hindi, what you call apnapan, which is you feel familial to somebody you feel connected with, right? So you may not know someone, but you might call them your older sister or your uncle, you know? And so for a lot of people, I obviously do not have a few hundred thousand younger siblings, but they will call me older siblings because that's the connection they feel. And so recognizing that, I'm like, okay, let me lean into that more. It's what I am naturally in life. Being an older sister is a huge part of my identity. And so as I grow, that feels a little bit more, I'm no longer your age and relatable. but I am a little bit, perhaps, I don't think wiser, but older and therefore have more life experience. And I think that'll continue to grow. I've seen people naturally do that as they enter different stages of life. You know, for example, these are things that would be nice to have, but they're not milestones I'm particularly chasing. But if I decide to get engaged or married at some point, if I decide to have a family of whatever shape at some point, those will be different stages of life that you might be able to bring people along to. Like I consume content of folks who are currently pregnant. I am not, and I have no intention of being anytime soon, but it's interesting learning, right? And it's cool to see their experiences. So I think it's just, you keep growing, you keep sharing, and those are parts of aging where it's just like you meet people through different stages.
Right. And those ages and stages are, they're just anchors and milestones, as you mentioned, you know, in life at different ways. It's easy to, and in some ways fun to sort of relate, you know, as a bystander. And you're right, that does take on a little bit different of a twist to things when you hear yourself called Avantitai or Avantana.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that's, yeah, it's a different way to feel about things, and you realize that you have multiple identities and at different phases of your life. And in thinking about that and some of the questions that you raise, right, whether it's about sex or masturbation or gender equity or even getting into Harvard, you know, the awkward questions that, you know, you ask people with, you know, those whether they're your parents or even your peers, for that matter, there almost is a real nice border between provoking thought and being provocative. And even sort of socially confrontational. And in some ways, learning about your content and viewing some of your content, I actually love that. I'm curious, is that an aim to somehow live at that border and keep discovering those edges of how do you provoke thought? How do you become socially conscious of these questions without being provocative or confrontational in a way?
Yeah, I don't think that was necessarily intentional, but it just feels authentic because I've always been somebody who is constantly provoking thought, but most people who knew me would not ever call me rebellious, right? I think when I was in school, I was pretty cookie cutter in that way, but at the same time would still question things. And I think it's just because of the structures that I grew up in where I think that comes from a sense of privilege where you can question, right, without necessarily having to. But it was, my mom describes it as like not just her, but a few folks, they call it like a gentle loudness in the sense of, I don't think I'm a loud person, but I think I know ways to get my point across.
Yeah.
And that's come in, I used to do a debate in high school, and it just so happened that there were more boys participating than girls. And my team would always have three boys plus me, right? And many of the boys would go up and be like, la, 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 la. And then I would come in and be like, so, let's, you know? And I recognize that sometimes people pay attention, right, to that as well. And so it's just recognizing in what spaces you have to have whatever expression.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, and I think that social conversation is really important to me, but I've recognized that not everybody, I'll give you an example. I made a video talking about feminism a few months ago and explaining from an equity lens, right? That just sounds fancy. I was just trying to explain that it's all about, you know, equity and making sure people have opportunity and breaking structures of oppression. But how do you explain that to an audience that may not know what those words mean, number one? Number two, might be already opposed to the word. Like the word feminism has had such a bad rap, you know, because people associate it with angry feminists and whatever that means. And someone who is loud and proud in their expression is incredible. And you're just intimidated by that. And that's your problem, right? And that's your discomfort you have to confront. But recognizing that that's what people associate, I'm like, okay, how do I explain this? Where it still comes across. And so I was doing my makeup while explaining it. And I used different bottle sizes to explain the different starting points people have in life and all of that. And for whatever reason, that video is now doing the rounds again on the internet. And I see people arguing in the comment section. That makes me happy because that means that it's reaching an audience that otherwise wouldn't be provoked by that thought. Because if it was only people being like, yeah, I'm feminist, then I'd be like, okay, echo chamber, this is a bad thing, right? Because it's not in the space. But what I guess I've realized is you can have that conversation many ways. I was at a gender equity conference recently, and I had a conversation in a more intellectual way. That was me literally being like, hey, I'm doing my makeup, and let's also talk about feminism, right? There are other structures in which I put on the more intellectual, let's use the 10,000 buzzwords hat, and there are some places in which I have to be a little bit louder because I know that you need to be loud in some spaces to have your voice heard. So I think it's just approaching it with different lenses.
Yeah, it's almost like reading the temperature of the different rooms and understanding context. And I think that's a great and very, in fact, thoughtful way to present the material. Again, sort of balancing that idea of like having great social conversations, you know, in a way that people can relate to in the right moments as well. We'll get you out of here on this. I think we've been chatting now for some time, and you've been such a sport to entertain, you know, my questions. I'm curious now, what questions are you asking yourself these days? And are those questions helping you cultivate trust?
I've been in a very existential phase recently where I've just been asking myself a lot of questions about what do I really want in life? Am I happy with the way things are professionally, personally, otherwise? I think that, if I'm being super honest, I think that I have a very relational lens to myself. I think about myself as how I relate to others very, very strongly. And therefore, I feel most authentic in relationships, you know, meaning with people, romantically, otherwise. And I realize I rarely do that with myself. And I need to learn how to spend more time alone. Because sometimes my thoughts scare me. And so that's something that I'm learning to grow into. So I might have a better answer for you in a few months when I spend more time with myself. But I'm trying not to take an objective relational lens to myself and being like, hey, I'm here.
Does that help you build trust in your own direction? Does it make you trust your compass a little bit more, especially as you go along?
I think so. I hope so. I think one thing that I am working on because it's interesting. I think I feel very assured and confident in many ways, but I think a lot of it stems from, you know, deep rooted like self-worth, self-esteem things that I just need to work through.
Yeah.
I think if you have a few self-worth, self-esteem issues, the person you trust least is yourself. And
sure.
That's funny because I know that I am a person who can be trusted. People trust me with a lot of information. So I'm like, okay, relationally,
yeah.
If other people are like, you can be trusted, why can you not trust yourself? And that's just something I'm learning to work through.
Well, I know so many people are relating to you and with you and appreciating the work that you're doing. Avanti, thank you so much for joining us. This was such a treat, and I hope we can revisit with you down the road.
Yes, I would love that. Thank you so much for having me. And so my favorite podcasts for conversations of this nature are usually with very young people because I find that they're the most thought-provoking. And this has been one of my favorite conversations I've had in a very long time, and I'm not just saying that because I'm on your podcast. I really appreciate the intentionality and the way in which you really, you know, took off and asked these questions that were thought-provoking but at the same time held space, you know, for what was there. So I really appreciate that. And to everyone watching, listening, please make sure you like, comment, share, subscribe. Find the podcast everywhere for more such conversations. All the things, because that's how you...
All the things.
Yes, all the things.
Thanks so much, Avanti. And of course, please check out Avanti's work on social media and her music wherever you might be listening. As always, try and practice random and intentional acts of kindness. And speaking of kindness, here's a good dad joke. Why do cows have hooves instead of feet? It's because they lack toes. Till next time, I'm Abhay Dandekar.